Let's speak with Red Cross CEO of the Red Cross in Connecticut and Rhode Island, Richard Branigan. And Melissa, in the mornings, nice enough to share your contact info with us. So happy to have you here. Richard, if you could first update us on how many folks from Connecticut have headed down south, roughly, to help.
Hi, Bridget, and thanks for the opportunity to be here and have a conversation. So far, we have close to 36 of our Connecticut and Rhode Island folks down there, primarily volunteers who have stopped their lives, put their lives on hold, put their Red Cross vests on, and headed south to help others in need.
Isn't that something? Okay, I have a lot of questions about logistics, because I always wonder, when you're heading down there and the situation I just described, no power, a lot of people still don't have cell service, water, so many issues. First of all, Richard, how do they physically get there? How do they travel there?
So our folks get a deployment order, and I keep checking my emails to see if mine is coming yet.
If your number is up, interesting.
Yeah, my number is going to be up sooner than later. But we have a very good system of deploying folks. We do this on a routine basis. We're the largest nonprofit that responds to disasters. We're chartered by Congress to do so. So we need to have our act together, and we do. And when folks agree and put their deployment availability into our system, then when they're title comes up and their name comes up, they're given a deployment order. They basically take that to our internal travel agent that books them on the closest and most convenient flight. A lot of those flights take multiple legs because we're flying on donated miles in many cases. So there are a lot of partnerships at play, but we tend to get into as close of proximity to the affected area of operations as we can. Sometimes that's pre-landfall, as we did with Helene, and getting folks down in time to be there and to open up our evacuation shelters, which is really necessary in many of these more predictable disasters that we respond to. Or then after the landfall, as we're sending our folks down there now, they would be flying into places like Charlotte or Raleigh or Atlanta, and then making smaller plane connections or driving into the theater of disaster operations. We also send a number of people with our emergency response vehicles. They're sent out in twosomes. They take our vehicles. We deployed three just the day before yesterday that headed down into the area. They were heading into the Carolinas. And they will go immediately into action and start feeding and helping with emergency relief supplies and so forth. So we're fairly sophisticated in how we respond. We do so typically in a 12 to 24 hour time frame.
Yeah, you guys do amazing work whenever there's a disaster in this country. And, you know, I was just saying a moment ago, it's just so tough getting around down there now using mules. I saw people using almost like a line through the woods, ferrying supplies up and down. And I don't know if you saw it. There was a story in the Times this morning about community leaders having a tough time just getting information to residents. They're now doing the good old fashioned town meeting and having people assemble and getting information the old fashioned way, telling them things in person. Right. So how do you get to the people who need help, and how do they get to you?
Yeah, Bridget, we work under what's called the unified command structure. So we're part of the response that happens with local and state and actually federal emergency management. So we're not working independently. Our responses are coordinated. And I'll give you a good example of that. We're operating a shelter in a county in or around the Asheville area. And the only way to bring in supplies, not by mule, I like the creativity there, but we were using a National Guard Chinook helicopter. And if people want to, in your listening area, want to imagine what a Chinook they looks like or sounds like, it is the largest two-bladed helicopter that you can imagine. And the folks that are familiar with Sikorsky aircraft know helicopters pretty well. So This is a large aircraft bringing in supplies, and our volunteers are offloading that into our shelter operations on the ground. And that's the only means that we've had to provide support and materials for those that are in our shelters in that particular area.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, you have to coordinate with the government and the president was in the Carolinas yesterday, and now he's going to Florida and Georgia today, and they of course have to coordinate logistically, flying overhead for the most part, so that the president doesn't interfere with any of your good work, the work on the part of volunteers to help the victims of the hurricane. We're on with Richard Branigan, the CEO of the Red Cross Connecticut and Rhode Island region here on Newsline. What are the most immediate needs of the folks who have been displaced by the hurricane?
I think we're talking about the basic necessities of life. We're talking about food and water and shelter and providing a safe place for our folks that have been impacted and making sure that our folks are safe in that process. So trying to get a handle on what the extent of the damages are, what the physical needs might be. There are still search and rescue operations. You mentioned the death toll is climbing now over 200 is my latest information. And, you know, that's going to continue to be the trend. So it's a very devastated area, a fluid situation, a lot of emotions at stake here, and a lot of physical needs that are imperative to be met. So life safety is something that we are endeavoring to maintain and doing that in a very safe way.
So you're basically providing shelter and food. In these situations, you always think about the families with kids and pets and how in the world they are able to set up at a shelter and live their lives. Although kids are so resilient, right? You know, they probably find a way to entertain themselves and make the best of a horrible situation. What is it like for families in the shelters?
You mentioned pets, too. We try and accommodate pets as well because they are part of families. You know, when we have a family unit, we do our best to keep the family units together in a shelter situation. We may have hundreds of people in a particular shelter, but we do our best to keep those families together as much as we can. There's not a lot of privacy, but our workers are trained in how to interact with people who are in the shelter. We have specialists that are there as well that help them with the transition to longer-term housing when that comes about, but more importantly, taking care of their health needs. They may need medications. They may have left their home in a hurry and did not take their daily medications with them. There's also an extreme amount of pressure on families, a lot of stress on individuals. So we have a very well-trained and supportive disaster mental health team, an emotional support team that will be there to provide comfort and emotional support for the families as they may need it. And they've had a lot of experience in doing this, and we work with local partners, and we work with members of the faith community. There is no stronger bond in many cases than the members of that community have with their local church. So we work in combination with local resources. We are really good at networking and providing the structure under which some of these local resources can interact with our government partners as well.
Let's continue our conversation now with Richard Branigan, CEO of the Red Cross in Connecticut, the Rhode Island region as well. We've been talking, of course, about the rescue efforts in the South, the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, and how long do people wind up, Richard? We were just talking about what it is like for a family to have to stay in a shelter, for anybody to have to stay in a shelter after being displaced from their home. How long typically before you can work out a different housing situation in a crisis like this?
So, Bridget, that does change from disaster to disaster. And in many cases, you know, one of the challenges that we have in foremost terms is longer term housing. We deal with three H's in our world of Red Cross disaster relief, and that's health, housing, and hunger. And we seem to have more connectivity and better success and easier time navigating through the health and the hunger issues. And we have a lot of community partners that can step up and help with that, and seems to be less of a challenge with those areas. Still a challenge, no doubt, but less of a challenge. The longer term housing presents a challenge for us each and every day and night, no matter where we are. And it might be in a local fire, but in a disaster of this proportion, where we're talking about five states impacted, and we're talking about the impact of a 1,000-year storm event. And to put that into context, here in Connecticut, we had a very similar event about a month and a half ago in the western towns, all the way down to Wilton, Westport, and the impact from Southbury down was devastating. And trying to put that into context, that was kind of a microcosm of a storm like Helene. And housing is a significant issue in long term. And in many cases, roads are washed out, but houses are washed away and there's nothing to replace them with. So we've seen it here in Connecticut, but they're experiencing it in the Carolinas at a scale that we have not seen before. And we're attempting to deal with longer term housing where we need to mobilize some of our partners. And we work hand in glove with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We work on long term recovery with them. But housing tends to be a challenge for us. And when you're looking at neighborhoods and communities that have been washed away, our longer-term plan for housing, temporary housing and shelters, those plans will continue and those operations will continue for the months ahead. We do not leave a community. And in fact, in Maui, where we responded to the wildfires just over a year ago, we still have a housing operation there in conjunction with our partners at FEMA and the state of Hawaii. So we don't walk away and close our doors on a shelter. We will stay in those communities until the mission is accomplished.
Yeah, you don't leave. Sadly, often we in the media we do, right? I mean, we cover something for a period of time, and then I don't want to say it's forgotten, but it might not be the lead story, and there might not be as much focus. So it's particularly wonderful that you folks with the Red Cross, you stay and you help the people in the long term. By the way, you mentioned the August flooding, Oxford, among the places really hard hit. In our next half hour, we are going to be chatting about a new FEMA center heading up to sort of help people with the paperwork, if you will, to make home repairs and such, if there are homes to be repaired, as you point out. Okay, so people listening to us, Richard Branigan, CEO of the Red Cross Connecticut and Rhode Island region, I'm sure a lot of people, if they're not packing their bags and helping physically, They would love to donate. What is the very best thing and the most efficient way for somebody listening to do that?
Bridget, thank you so much. If people are listening, there's a few easy ways to do this. One is to jump on our redcross.org website. It's fairly straightforward. Or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. They can donate very simply by texting the word Helene, H-E-L-E-N-E, to 90999. That's a simple way of doing things. If they want to explore volunteering for us and being part of our cadre of heroes that roll up their sleeves and lead with their hearts, they're welcome to do that through those mechanisms as well, through the redcross.org website, and click on the volunteer button, and that will take them into that pathway. And what we find, people have some misconceptions about what the Red Cross does. They sometimes get confused and think because we respond with FEMA that we are an arm of the federal government. We are not. We work in conjunction with the federal government. We have a charter to respond to disasters. So that's part of our core mission. But we're funded by the generosity of the American public, and that's put into motion by the work of our amazing volunteers. So we rely on that generosity to help us deliver our services and to bring hope to those communities. The other thing that people can do that's very simple, if they can't afford a financial donation or a commitment of time and they have an hour to give, then they could step up and donate blood. There's a blood local crisis now in the Carolinas and in surrounding states because all of those blood drives are shut down and because we're trying to get supplies in and out of those affected communities. So by doing a local blood donation, you ensure that we're able to meet demand wherever that is. And that's easy too. It's either going on our 1-800 Red Cross phone number or to our website and looking at blood donations, typing in their home zip code or wherever it's convenient for them. And in about an hour, they can make a blood donation and feel really good about the fact that they've done that to help others.
That sounds like a great thing. Richard Branigan, the CEO of the Red Cross Connecticut and Rhode Island region, thank you so much for chatting with us. More than happy to get the word out. We will put our conversation that we just had on our podcast, and we will make sure to let people know during the course of the Newsline hours that they can donate 1-800-RED-CROSS or redcross.org. Richard, thank you so very much.
Bridget, thank you for having us. We appreciate your support.
We appreciate you. Right now, we want to turn to the issue of domestic abuse. If you've been listening to WICC and our programming through the course of this week, you have no doubt heard some really, really horrific stories. In fact, we had an update to that story out of Bridgeport where a mom and her two boys were beaten with a bat. It's such a horrible thing. And today we got word that one of the boys had indeed died. We are on live now on Newsline with Mary Jane Foster, the CEO and president of Interval House. And you were quoted, Mary Jane, this week as saying that the violence just seems to be even more brutal. What do you suspect is going on?
First of all, let me say thank you so much for having me. Interval House is a domestic violence agency, one of 18 in the state. We serve Hartford and the surrounding region, but I cut my chops. I became a volunteer in Bridgeport at what is now the Center for Family Justice. So it's great to be on with you and speaking to folks in Bridgeport and the entire region.
It's great to have you here, Mary Jane. Go ahead.
Thank you. So what I have said earlier this week, and I'm saying over and over again, so that maybe it registers with people, in the last 6 weeks, we have had a murder-suicide in East Hartford, a murder-suicide in Ansonia, a vicious assault in Naugatuck, a young girl, 16 years old, shot in the head by her boyfriend in Hartford. In Bridgeport, we had a man shoot the mother of his child in the street. And then, of course, it was followed by this horrific incident where this man took a baseball bat to his girlfriend and her two boys, and one is now dead, and the other two lives forever changed. So, you know, the number of incidents are rising. At Interval House, we've seen an increase of over 30% in victims that we are serving, and we have also seen an increase in the intensity of violence, the murder-suicides, the baseball bats, the strangulations. It's almost as though it's not just enough to shoot someone from a distance, but it has to be a hands-on type of violence.
Vicious, hateful really, crimes.
It really is. And
what's going
on,
Mary Jane?
Logic.
Yeah, it does defy logic. And you hear it and you say, well, any violence is horrible, right? But yeah, the way right. you describe it, it seems to be a particularly strong brand of brutality. Why is this happening this way?
You know, it's hard to know. When we talk about intimate partner abuse, the important thing to remember about it is that it happens because of one person's need to control another. Everything else that happens is a trigger. So when you think about this intensity and the increase, it has to be that abusers are believing that they're losing control, and that propels them to these actions. You know, the other statistic I want everybody to hear is that we were pleased that the average number of homicides in Connecticut had come down to 12. Well, last year it was 19. And so we are headed in the wrong direction. Excuse me. And I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm grateful for October because it shines a light on this issue. One of the issues that we have is that people do not believe that domestic violence is prevalent. The CDC says 12 million Americans report domestic abuse every year. It's 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men, and 1 in 3 teenagers are reporting abuse in dating relationships. This is everywhere.
1 in 4 women. 1 in 4 women. I was not aware of that statistic. That is,
oh, absolutely.
That is astonishing.
It is. It you know,
horrifying,
I
should say.
When,
yeah.
It is. And when I stand in a room speaking to 100 people, I can't help but wonder, as I count to 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, how many victims I'm looking at. Because it is everywhere. If it hasn't happened to you, it's happened to someone you know or someone you will know, and it may circle back to you.
Mary Jane, I asked you why, and I know that's a really broad question and a tough question to answer, but I do remember in the dark days of the pandemic, we did see an increase in domestic abuse, in part because people were cooped up together. And sadly and horrifyingly, some partners took it out on their partner. And yet the pandemic has ebbed. But here we are. And right. I guess my question is, if you're in a relationship where you feel like a partner is trying to control you, when do you know that that could be dangerous? And when you should seek help?
Sure. That's a great question. We all expected the numbers to rise with the isolation and the increase in control. What we didn't expect but should have thought of is that when we opened back up, the abusers lost control because suddenly, you know, you could get out. You could go to work. You could go to the grocery store. You could go to your house of faith. You could see your family. And so things got worse. One of the things that's happened in Connecticut, and Connecticut really has been a front runner in progressive legislation, is that we included a couple of years ago coercive control into the legal definition of domestic violence. And people say, how will I know if I'm in a coercive controlled relationship? And I say to them, if your heart is in your throat when you walk into your house, if you feel like you are walking on eggshells, you are in a relationship where there is coercive control. Where are you going? Why are you wearing that? You don't need to do this. You could be doing that. All of those sort of controlling things. Why are you working that job? Why do you need to do this? What did you do with that dinner? I don't like your family. Whatever it is that controls your freedom is the very, to me, it's the beginning. It's the essence of intimate partner abuse.
The beginning of
it.
And that's when you need to start thinking about it. And we have been tackling the topic of domestic abuse, and rejoining us on Newsline is the CEO and president of Interval House, Mary Jane Foster. Mary, such an important conversation. And you mentioned a moment ago when you should start to think about whether your relationship is controlling, when you have that pit in your stomach about being with your partner. Okay, so that's the start. At what point, what signs do you look for? At what point do you say, you know what? It is time to leave. It is time to get myself some help and seek the safety of a shelter.
Well, I think that moment is different for everyone.
Sure.
You know, a victim always knows better about his or her place in that sort of continuum, if you will. But if you begin to feel fearful for your safety, if you begin to feel as though the escalation is absolutely changing and limiting your life, and that could be in a number of ways. One of the increases we're seeing is in financial abuse, where an abuser will say, that's a crummy job, you don't need that job, you know, I can take care of you. And so a victim will quit his or her job, and the next thing you know, it's, we should have a joint account. I mean, silly to have two, right? So just close yours and I'll put you on mine. Oh, and I got you a credit card. Oh, and here's your new phone. And all of a sudden, we have, I'm going to say women because 80% of those we serve are women, come to us. They have no job. They have no checking account, savings account, or credit card that they're owned, and their phone is owned by someone else. I've heard it likened to the story about putting the frog in warm water, and the frog doesn't realize it's being boiled until that water is bubbling. Mm. And so victims in hindsight see this. But pay attention, and when you feel an escalation in control, when you feel an escalation in your own fear and wariness, you know, those eggshells are becoming sharper and bigger under your feet, that is certainly the time to reach out to one of the domestic violence agencies in the state, call the hotline or the statewide hotline, and just speak to an advocate. Unbelievably, we have about 5,000 calls that come into Interval House every year. More than half of them are just for information. If you think about it, you know, you are with someone you fell in love with. You put your hope, your faith, and your trust in this person, and it's turned dark, and you don't know why. You don't know what it is that's happening to you. So get some information. Either Google your local domestic violence agencies or information on intimate partner abuse, or call a hotline and talk with someone. Again, you don't have to be in crisis.
Right.
Just if things don't feel right to you, reach out. We have resources. The first thing we do is help a victim with a safety plan. What will make you, are you safe now? How can we help you keep safe?
Right.
And we work with that victim.
And maybe trust your instincts a bit. Mary Jane Foster, CEO, president of Interval House, hope to have you on the show again to talk more about this really important topic. Very quickly, before I let you off the news line, for your organization, Interval House, do you want to give us a quick website or number to call?
Sure. Well, Interval House, which serves the Hartford region, is our hotline is 860-838-8467.
Okay.
But for everyone across the state, there is Connecticut Safe Connect, and that number is 888-774-2900. That's 888-774-2900.
Mary Jane Foster, many, many thanks to you, CEO, president of Interval House.